The headlines. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says it's a grave mistake to back down vis-a-vis the United States in an attempt to remain immune against sanctions. The foreign ministers of Russia and Ukraine meet in Turkey, the first such high-level talks since the start of the conflict between the two countries. And the United Nations says more than 2.3 million people have fled Ukraine since the start of the Russian military campaign 2 weeks ago. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says Iran will not budge over its regional presence or its nuclear progress vis-a-vis the adversary seeking to pressure the country. Addressing members of the Assembly of Experts, Ayatollah Seyedani Khamenei said it would be a big mistake for Iran to back down on its stances vis-a-vis the United States so as to protect itself against sanctions. He said such naive recommendations have been made to Iranian officials in the past, but have been rejected. Ayatollah Khamenei says Iran would be facing grave threats today if those proposals had been enacted. Iran is standing its ground in the ongoing Vienna talks with President Ebrahim Raisi, saying that there will be no backing down from the red lines. Raisi says his government seeks the removal of sanctions in a dignified manner and will strictly follow the guidelines set by Iran's leader, Ayatollah Seyedani Khamenei. His comments come shortly after Iran's top security official said the U.S. approach towards the talks shows that Washington has no desire for a good deal. Ali Shamkhani said the way Washington is approaching Iran's proposals, the unacceptable proposals it tables, and its desire for a quick agreement all indicate a lack of will for a strong deal that's acceptable to both sides. According to the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, the Vienna talks are becoming more complicated by the hour because the U.S. is refraining from making a political decision. The news review where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this edition, condemnations pour in as Turkey is hosting the first Israeli leader in 14 years. Palestinian resistance groups join Turkish citizens in denouncing Israeli President Isaac Herzog's visit, which is seen as an attempt to normalize ties between Ankara and Tel Aviv. The Islamic Jihad movement says the trip means Turkey is siding with the regime at the expense of Palestinians' resistance. The movement calls the normalization of ties with Israel a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. Hamas also expresses concerns over recent trips of Israeli officials to regional countries. The resistance group calls on Arab and Muslim governments to show greater solidarity with the Palestinians and do not allow the regime to make inroads into the region. Herzog's visit has sparked street protests in Turkey. In a protest in Istanbul, people remembered the Israeli deadly raid on a Turkish aid ship to Gaza back in 2010.
This is a great pain and a torment. It is like a knife to our people's chest. This is what I am thinking because it is against humanity and against Islam. There is a usurping state of Israel, and it is also illegitimate and a murderer. They are always pursuing terrorist acts in the Middle East. This meeting will do no good.
The protesters urge their government to correct what they called a mistake of boosting ties with the regime. Turkey's relations with Israel has seen ups and downs in recent years. Ankara recalled its envoy after a deadly raid on a ship in 2010, which was part of a flotilla trying to breach a blockade on the Gaza Strip. Turkey's relations with the regime gradually improved, but soured again in 2018 in the wake of Israel's deadly attacks on Gaza. Protesters, now Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Herzog, have proclaimed a new era in relations following a meeting in Ankara. Erdogan says Herzog's visit will be a turning point in Turkey-Israel relations. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Mona Kandil, who's joining us from Ramallah. Also, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who's joining us from Ottawa. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mona in Ramallah. Mona, Palestinian resistance groups have also chimed in denouncing the Israeli President Isaac Herzog's visit to Turkey. Tell us more, please.
Yes, that's shocked the Hamas movement issued a statement condemning Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's meeting and receiving with welcome and ceremony the president of the Israeli occupation, Ishaq Herzog, and saying that they express the sorrow over these visits by the Israeli officials to Arab and Islamic countries, and the last was to Turkey. They believe that this visit had let the Palestinians down, had let Al-Quds down, and also they consider the strategic depth of the Palestinian people and their just national cause, and they hoped that Turkey, they preferred that Turkey would not receive the Israeli president. Also, the Jihad movement has also condemned the visit, and they issued a more full-throated denounce, let's say, the end of the relationship between Turkey and Israel. But then, as everyone knows, they renewed this relationship recently. In a few years, of course.
Let's cross over to Elijah Magny in Ottawa. Elijah, what do you see in this restarting of relations between Ankara and the Israeli regime? We saw some of the family members and survivors of the Mavi Marmara incident speaking there. Has Ankara put the Mavi Marmara incident behind?
Thank you for having me. I think it is more than that. So the relationship observed ups and downs since 2007, and the 2010 Marmara event, or the 2016, the recall of the ambassadors, all these are not applied today because President Erdogan has a philosophy that what belongs to yesterday, it belongs to yesterday, and what belongs to today, belongs to today. And we understand that President Erdogan is not acting out of an ideology, because you don't change your ideology from one day to another, but out of interest and benefit. And we understand that from what President Erdogan is saying, although he is the more or less one of the Hamas godfather that both adopt the Muslim Brotherhood doctrine, he's saying that it's time to look after our interests. And his interest today is to bring the Israeli gas and to be the channel between Israel and Europe, Russia and Europe through the Third Stream, and be really the hub between the East and the West. Now, that's one of his biggest advantages. Secondly, he observed that throughout the years, out of 15 years of bad relationship with Israel, he is not the leader of the Arab countries or the Muslim countries. So he is one of the leaders, and now we see that his relationship with Israel that is developing is really putting him on the bottom of the leadership, because nothing distinguishes him from any other country that is normalizing the relationship with Israel.
Mr. Magny, let's focus on that last one. Does Israel want to sell its natural gas to Europe, and is it seeing as a Turkey being the main alternative here?
Yes, that is related to the war in Ukraine today between Russia and the U.S. on the Ukrainian soil. And we see how Russia did not weaponize the energy and the delivery of gas to European countries, mainly to Germany and to other European countries. Therefore, what Turkey is offering is saying, well, my channel is a more secure one, and I have always been willing and wanting to join the European Union, but the European Union has always refused to bring in Turkey. It is an opportunity to count on the Turkish support, particularly in energy and gas in this case, and they can expect that Turkey, that already connected with Russia through the Third Stream to receive gas from Turkey and to keep this energy flowing into Europe that is finding itself in a deep trouble with the war in Ukraine and the sanctions that they are imposing on Russia, and they are afraid what Russia could do in return. So by Turkey offering itself as the alternative and a more secure way, this is really not very connected to the reality, because at the end of the day, it is still the Russian gas that going to Turkey and from Turkey to other European countries if Russia continue the delivery. So what Turkey is saying, well, the Israelis can deliver it gas to Europe, and I can be the go-between Israel and Europe with a new gas line that can connect European and fulfill their need.
One last question for Mona in Ramallah. One of the reactions that we just read out said, where are the slogans of Quds and Islam, alluding to Turkey and the Turkish president, which was very critical of the Israeli regime over the Israeli wars on the besieged Gaza Strip, and of course the blockade and the attacks on Gaza war protesters. Did Palestinians feel that Turkey now as well is turning its back on the plight of the Palestinians?
Exactly. It's not surprising, but the Palestinians, of course, are angry. It's the same thing when Arab state had turned from the secret contacts and relationship with Israel into clear normalization. And now, after these years, Turkey is again welcoming Israeli president and opening a new, chapter in relationship. And of course, Palestinians could see this move as yet another step in their back. At the time, they are demanding and urging the world, whether Arab and Islamic states, in order to stand with them, stand with Al-Quds and the just rights of the Palestinians.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Candiel, joining us from Ramallah. And also thanks to journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on. Welcome back. Russia and Ukraine's foreign ministers have met in Turkey for the first high-level talks since the start of the conflict 2 weeks ago. In a press conference that was held right after the meeting, Russia's Sergei Lavrov said the actual course of negotiations to resolve the conflict are ongoing in Belarus. He slammed the West for providing weapons to Kiev, creating danger in the region and making Ukraine what he called an instrumental tool. Lavrov said Moscow only wants to see a neutral Ukraine, and that Russia has no intentions of attacking any other country and is prepared to offer Ukraine security guarantees. The Ukrainian foreign minister, for his part, called on Russia for humanitarian corridors primarily out of the crisis-ridden city of Mariupol. Dmytro Kuleba said Russia seems to be continuing its assault, adding he had the impression that Moscow is not in a position to agree on a ceasefire. He said Ukraine will not surrender. Meanwhile, the United Nations says more than 2.3 million people have fled Ukraine since the start of the Russian military campaign. Writer and political analyst John White joins us now from Edinburgh. Mr. White, walk us through the comments that were made by the foreign ministers of both Russia and Ukraine following the first round of talks in the Turkish city of Antalya.
Well, based on the trajectory of the conflict hitherto, the remarks made by Mr. Lavrov and his Ukrainian counterpart are no surprise. It's disappointing that they couldn't come to terms or come close to agreeing the terms of a ceasefire. The obduracy of the Ukrainians is clearly designed to try and inflame and incite public opinion in the West with the view to putting pressure on Western governments to do more. Mr. Zelensky is going out of his way to call for a no-fly zone, which would pitch Europe into a major conflagration. World War III, people are referring to this, and that's true, because Russia is a nuclear armed power. It's a massive country, and it is not like Libya after sanctions or Iraq after sanctions. There would be a huge blowback. It's clear to me that Mr. Zelensky needs to get off the phone to Biden and get on the phone to Putin. He has been led up the hill by the West and abandoned there. He needs to ditch the khaki, and he needs to do whatever it takes to stop this madness. Russian tanks are right now 13 miles away from the center of Kiev.
I'd also like to get your thoughts on a comment that was made by the Russian foreign minister. One, of course, he said, "We will come out of this crisis with refreshed views of the world, with no illusions about the West." Unpack that for us as well. Also, he said that Lavrov said that the denials of the United States regarding the biological labs in Ukraine are unsurprising. Why would the United States want these labs in Ukraine?
Well, on your first question, it's clear that the US and its allies in the West, by trying to cancel Russia, are only accelerating within weeks what Russia has been trying to do for the last 10 years in conjunction with China and other members of the anti-hegemony bloc that exists in all but name, includes Iran, Venezuela, etc., in speeding the day of multipolarity, de-dollarization, and ending reliance on Western global corporations. So the West is shooting itself in the foot by withdrawing all its businesses, its investments from Russia, and indeed trying to place a chokehold on Russian exports of gas and oil. It's going to be self-defeating. We're already seeing fuel prices in the pump in Western countries going through the roof. So there's going to add to the already existing cost of living crisis. As to these biological weapons labs, well, this is part of the architecture of Western hegemony. They're trying to push NATO right up to Russia's eastern border, and they're trying to do so using Ukraine also as a cat's paw to exert pressure on Russia, because they've never forgiven Russia for recovering from the debacle of the 1990s, where they tried to impose this free market experiment on the Russian people, to the huge detriment to Russia and its people. Russia's now back is a major power, and the West has never forgiven Russia for coming back, because in the mind of the Western ideologue, Russia can only ever exist as a deadly enemy or a vanquished foe, never as a partner.
All right, thanks a lot, writer and political analyst John White, joining us from Edinburgh. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The endeavors of social service activists and activists in the area of pious health, examples of whose work the Iranian nation were witness to in the last 2-3 years on various matters. The activities by people in the area of military defense and the jihad of clarification. This is the same thing that Mr. Ali Hashem, Tabriz Friday Prayer leader, explained in his speech. The activities done by hardworking government officials in the three branches of government, the personnel who are busy working in a sincere and genuine manner, the enlightening activities done by political intellectuals. There are many individuals who clarify political matters for the people in various media. Fortunately, today, this is being done in cyberspace by the individuals with a sense of responsibility it is also being done in the press and primarily in the national media. Help given to the centers of resistance by those who support the centers of resistance in our region and in the world of Islam. These people are in fact working for the sake of the continuation of the revolution.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I could also mention the people who are prepared to participate in various arenas. For instance, when the issue of defending the shrines occurs, some people enter the field. Sometimes certain incidents take place inside the country, such as the ninth of day. Of course, in Tabriz, the people enter the field one day sooner, on the eighth of day, and some people enter the arena. All these movements are in line with the continuation of the revolution. All these are constituents of a public movement, which I call the movement of the continuation of the revolution. All these movements are done by looking to the big and lofty goals of the revolution. Of course, these efforts are of two kinds. Some of these efforts are about the needs of the present, and some are about the future. The urgent needs of the present time are usually quickly recognized by the masses of the people, and with a quick mention, they recognize them and enter the field. This was the case in the Sacred Defense era.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The world is closely watching the Russia-Ukraine conflict as it can potentially end in outcomes that would send shockwaves across the globe. Russia launched what it calls a special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. That came despite weeks of warnings from Western capitals that such a move would bring catastrophic results. The United States and its allies decided not to confront Russia directly and resorted to supporting Ukraine with intelligence and military hardware. They launch another war that isn't fought with bullets or rockets, but affects banks and financial institutions, an economic war. Washington and its allies have announced several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mostly targeting its banks and energy sector. The scrapping of the highly anticipated Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would transfer Russian gas directly to Germany was among the measures. Moscow has already warned that it could cut its gas supplies to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline.
The implications of this event on the economy, the implications of this for the Russian economy, I don't think are quite as tragic as some of the Western press would like to have us believe, because I believe that the Russians have a great many more shock absorbers because they are less exposed than many of the Western capitalist economies.
The tensions risk escalating into a wider energy crisis in Europe, which has over the past year experienced shortages of fuel and price hikes. The military conflict and ensuing sanctions are already showing their effects, but not only on Russia. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the US and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked to close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs as deepening Western sanctions against Russia fueled concerns about exports from the Black Sea region. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Russia and Ukraine account for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market.
The economic impacts of this crisis, of this war, is not something that we're going to be able to that the world will not be able to undo, even if there is a peace treaty in the short term, because the disruptions and the lack of confidence in the old geopolitical arrangements is a permanent damage that will profoundly affect the world economy.
What should be taken into account is that you can't simply remove a cog from the system and expect it to continue working without a hitch. Sanctions might hurt Russia for the short term, but in the long run, everyone will lose.
A U.S. delegation of senior State Department and White House officials traveled to the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to meet with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The meeting is the highest-level visit by U.S. officials to Venezuela in years. It also coincides with an ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The question is, why should such a meeting take place at this time? Venezuela and the U.S. severed all diplomatic relations in 2019 following Washington's recognition of pro-U.S. opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president over the legitimate president Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. then imposed sanctions on individuals with ties to Maduro's government and on companies involved in exporting Venezuelan oil to provoke regime change in the Latin American country. Venezuela soon felt the impact of sanctions as its oil production reduced significantly. In response, Caracas turned to Russia, as well as Iran and China, for diplomatic and economic aid. Russian energy companies and banks have since played a major role in Venezuela's exporting of oil. Fast forward to today, Russia is involved in a conflict with Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will only halt his country's military operation if Ukraine is stopped fighting and if Moscow's demands are met. On the other hand, Western governments have targeted Russia with a barrage of sanctions. The U.S. has imposed a ban on the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, European Union has excluded 7 Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned 2 major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. And Germany has decided to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project. In a bid to punish Russia for attacking Ukraine, the US and its allies targeted Moscow's oil and gas sector via sanctions, and countries like Venezuela are potential substitutes. In addition, while the war in Ukraine continues unabated, Washington is paying closer attention to Moscow's allies in Latin America. Current and former US officials believe that's because Washington thinks they could become security threats if the standoff with Russia deepens.
The U.S. is going to try to divide Russia from Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly enough, according to the White House itself, a lot of the sanctions imposed on Russia over this whole Ukraine nonsense are designed to target Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, because those countries are also sanctioned by the U.S. And those countries are also dependent on Russia for aid. Russian support and aid is one of the main reasons why these countries have been able to overcome the sanctions to begin with. So in a sense, the U.S. is targeting these countries indirectly by hitting Russia, and I think people are not going to fall for it.
In a public speech on Thursday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stated that his country is open to discussing oil deals with investors from all around the world, including the U.S., in case Washington restricts the imports of Russian oil, Venezuela would be able to replace some of the lost supplies. The U.S. sees Latin America as an opportunity to advance its agenda among Latin American countries allied with Russia. But the U.S. is not that popular in Latin America for many reasons. In slightly less than 100 years, from 1898 to 1994, the U.S. intervened successfully to change governments in Latin America at least 41 times, or once every 28 months for an entire century.
The U.S. has launched a number of military coups to try to overthrow the Laughlin government in Venezuela. It has used all diplomatic and sanction means to try to do so. None of this has worked because the Venezuelan government has the backing of the people and also internationally has the support of countries like Russia, Iran, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, and many others that stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan government.
The United States has long interfered in the internal affairs of Nicaragua, a Latin American country it once occupied from 1912 to 1933 as part of the Banana Wars. Washington has imposed sanctions against Nicaragua's government and President Daniel Ortega's inner circle since 2018 when protests erupted in the country. Meanwhile, Cuba suffers from chronic shortages of electricity and food exacerbated by brutal U.S. sanctions. It also holds Washington responsible for stirring up violence in the country and blames its economic woes mainly on U.S. embargoes. And there is a long list of other countries in the region that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions and its intervention in their domestic affairs. While Washington seeks to find a substitute oil producer to fill in the place of Russia to further pressure Moscow by imposing stricter sanctions on its oil and gas, U.S.'s dark history continues to haunt it. Will Putin's Latin American allies stay loyal to him, or will they forget all hardship the U.S. has inflicted on their people for years? The Western media's portrayal of Ukraine's suffering is somehow different compared to those suffering from wars in other countries like Yemen, Libya, Ethiopia, Palestine, and Syria has sparked widespread criticism. News coverage of civilian Ukrainians defending their country by making Molotov cocktails and arming themselves with state-given machine guns has also been celebrated as heroic, and these people have been called freedom fighters. This empathy has not been voiced for others, like Palestinians who experience an identical crisis, yet are labeled terrorists when defending their land. The suffering in Ukraine must be highlighted. However, portraying Ukraine's pain as more human shows the deep hypocrisy at play. Now, the West has come under criticism over what is seen as double standards regarding conflicts in other parts of the world.
You're happy to correctly use the most strong and robust language to describe the crimes against humanity of Vladimir Putin, but you will not use the same strength of language when it comes to describing the Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, when it is now being documented and detailed by two of the most respected human rights organizations in the world, and indeed has been alleged by dozens and dozens of non-governmental organizations, and to be honest, anybody who looks honestly.
Barrett asked whether the Irish Parliament will impose sanctions against Israel. He also asked whether the Irish legislative body would support calls for referring Israel to international courts over its crimes against humanity. This is not the first time the Western media has shown its bias. A similar narrative was pushed against Palestinians last year. Israel's decades-long occupation, its crippling blockade and military grip over Palestinians, as well as a wave of demolitions, led to a two-week war that killed around 260 Palestinians and 13 Israelis. News outlets and political figures spoke out on the conflict, but it started with the opposite end of the story, starting with Palestinian reactions and violence. While Israel was the real aggressor, they focused on rockets fired by the Hamas resistance movement that came later in retaliation. The double standards of the US and the West are the focal point of tension, violence, and bloodshed, and make Washington an unacceptable mediator and the country that is unable to achieve stability in the world. The war in Yemen is another example. Scant coverage of the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis killed by arms from Western countries, especially the US. Yet the media portrays the real Yemeni army as the aggressor, and the ones doing the bombing as the ones who are following the path of righteousness. More than 1.3 million Ukrainians have fled their homeland so far since the beginning of the conflict with Russia. Countries like Hungary and Poland are being praised for letting in tens of thousands of people, and the EU is preparing measures that would offer temporary residence permits, as well as access to employment and social welfare. But the open-door policy of several states has highlighted an apparent double standard. These refugees can enter some countries more easily than those escaping violence in the Middle East or North Africa. For instance, Poland has welcomed those fleeing the Ukraine war while it pushed back against a wave of immigrants crossing over from Belarus, mostly from the Middle East and Africa, last year. Also, the reporting of this tragedy has seen double standards and Eurocentric bias that hold one group of human lives more valuable than others who are suffering conflicts in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
This was just one of many remarks on media outlets drawing the line between the conflict unfolding in Ukraine and those in other parts of the world. Many also drew a comparison between Europe's welcoming of Ukrainian refugees and the influx of Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans, which was declared a migrant crisis. The suffering of refugees from these countries is being played down and almost made to seem that their lives are not as important in comparison to the lives of those fleeing Ukraine. The Western media have been doing a biased reporting of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. The dehumanization of people of color, of those from countries that are not in the West, needs to stop. More needs to be done to improve for the future of building a united wider society, which values every single person as a human being.
Russia's decision to attack Ukraine has ushered in a new era in its relations with the West. The United States and its allies are supplying Ukraine with arms and providing it with intelligence to fight Russian troops. But they are not directly involved in the clashes.
The only way to actually implement something like a no-fly zone is to send NATO planes into Ukrainian airspace and to shoot down Russian planes. And that could lead to a full-fledged war. In Europe, President Biden has been clear that we are not going to get into a war with Russia.
Of course the U.S. doesn't want that, because if a war breaks out between the West and Russia, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. To avoid the doomsday scenario, the West has resorted to another form of warfare, the economic type. The United States and many of its allies have announced unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its financial, banking, and oil and gas sector, among others. These include sanctions on Russia's central bank, exclusion of several Russian banks from the SWIFT payment system, and a ban on Russian banks and companies' access to Western capital markets. In other words, Russia's engagement in dollar-denominated business will be severely affected. But let's not forget that for every action, there will be an opposite reaction.
Look, the dominance of the dollar has afforded America great global power, but it is now under real threat as never before, as Russia, China, and others economically challenge the U.S. Many are now seeking to ditch their dependence on the dollar, as Washington has continued to abuse its status as issuer of the world's reserve currency for decades, really, since after the Second World War.
Russia has already been working on plans to reduce its dependence on the trade in the dollar. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Beijing for the opening of the Winter Olympic Games in China in early February and met with his Chinese counterpart. It was President Xi Jinping's first face-to-face meeting with another head of state in nearly 2 years, which highlights the importance of the visit. The two leaders discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to the unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. Russia has been pursuing the policy for a while. Back in April 2021, the share of Russian exports in dollars fell below 50% for the first time. Moscow's trade with Beijing is mostly responsible for the dive. There's room for improvement, though, as the majority of trade between China and Russia is done in euro, with just over 30% of the transactions conducted in their national currencies. The sweeping sanctions on Russia may push China to speed up measures to break with the U.S. currency and create its own means of payment. The obvious option is the yuan, which is getting stronger than ever. In July, international trade in the Chinese currency set a new record, with many predicting that at this rate, the yuan will become the world's third strongest currency by 2030.
Beijing has been actively encouraging the use of its currency in trade transactions, especially under its massive Belt and Road Initiative, with China recovering more strongly than other big nations after the COVID crisis that we've had. Foreign capital has been flooding in too as Beijing opens its financial markets.
This means only one thing. Given the economic alliance between China and Russia, the sanctions might temporarily hurt Moscow, but in the long run, the West will be disarmed of its economic pressure tool.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see that most of the works that he has contributed to Shia library are related to the field of catechology.
So Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati is a friend of Ayatollah Marashi Najafi also. Mm-hmm. And he had many trips to different countries like Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and different, you know, cities. And he achieved the permission of ijtihad and also the permission of narration.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
The program, The Teacher, is about the lives and the works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, jurists, philosophers, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati, mainly known as Allama Rawzati, one of the bibliographers, scholars in the field of catechology and the study of manuscripts and hadith studies. So let's get to his early life, Shaykh Ziyaniya, with you, inshallah. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati, introduce him for us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati was born in 1308. In solar calendar, in Isfahan. And he was from the generation and offsprings of late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baghir Khansari, the famous marja' of Shia school of thought. And, you know, because of that marja', I mean the Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baghir Khansari, rahmatullah alayh, this household is the household of ulama and scholars.
That's right.
So the father of Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati also was a scholar himself and was a student of Asad Abul Hassan Isfahani, the great marja', Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini also. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati lost his father at 8. He was nurtured under the supervision of his grandfather.
From the mother's side, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, that's right.
Maternal grandfather.
Maternal father, okay.
And he started his Islamic studies in Isfahan and in Madrasa As-Sadr, that is a very famous school, Islamic seminary in Isfahan, an old one. And after studying as the preliminary studies, I mean, he moved to Qom, because Qom was a famous city from the time of late Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri on. And Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati moved to Qom to get benefit from the teachers, great teachers in Qom. And in this city, I mean, in the city of Qom, he participated in the courses of Sheikh Murtaza Ha'iri and also the courses of the great Ayatollah Burujerdi, rahmatullah alayhim ajma'in.
That's right.
And here also in this city, he got familiar with the great marja', late Ayatollah Mar'ashi Najafi, the That's great catechologist and also manuscript collector. That I think that most of the audiences are familiar with the personality of late Ayatollah Marashi Najafi. So Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati is a friend of Ayatollah Marashi Najafi also. Mm-hmm. And he had many trips to different countries like Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and different, you know, mm-hmm. cities. And he achieved the permission of ijtihad and also the permission of narration, because these two are different. Permission of ijtihad is showing and, you know, certifying that this person, this figure is authorized to deduce the fatwa and the verdicts from ayat and rivayat. Mm-hmm. And the permission of ijaza or narration of hadith is the permission by which it's showing that this figure, this person is eligible to transmit a hadith to other people and to narrate a hadith to other people.
So these are the two important ijazas that we have.
Yes.
For this ijaza to narrate a hadith and ijaza to become a mujtahid, isn't
it? Yeah.
Okay. And in the past, they used to get a letter or a recommendation, okay?
Yes, recommendation letter that shows these two types of certification.
Ijaza nama, that's right. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for a nice elaboration on the early life of Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rozati. And I think the Hawza and the School of Isfahan has produced great scholars during the history. Besides Qom, Mashhad, Najaf, and Karbala, Isfahan has also been famous for producing outstanding scholars. And the Takht-e-Fulat Cemetery in Isfahan is a place to the graves and the tombs of really outstanding great maraja, ulama, and scholars. This shows that this city has also had role in nurturing outstanding students. Okay, the main interest of Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rozati, I mean research interest, Sheikh Mahtavi, let's talk a little bit about them.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we look at the works of late Rozati, we see that most of the works that he has contributed to Shia library are related to the field of codicology or manuscripts that we have. So better to say that the most outstanding work that has been published by him or compiled by him is the edition that he did on the work of his ancestor, Rawdatul Jannat, that is related to the historiography of the great scholars of Shia, no matter in which field of study they are expert, from philosophers, mystics, jurists, and usulis, those who are expert in the field of usul, or the theory of the jurisprudence. If
this is an anthology, I think, isn't it? A collection of the names of the great outstanding scholars of the Shia ones during the history, isn't it?
Yes, okay. We have one of the best source in this regard is Al-Dhari'ah, being written and authored by Agha Buzurgi Tehrani.
That's right.
And this is good to know that late Rozati is considered as the students of Sheikh Agha Buzurgi Tehrani as well.
Okay.
And also Sayyid Mohsen Amin. These two also, they are interested in this field of study, and he got permission of ijtihad from Sheikh Agha Buzurgi Tehrani as well. Because authoring such works and conducting these huge books without getting the permission of the great ulama has no value in
That's
the
right.
eyes of the scholars.
Okay.
So in order to compile or do edition over such books and have your book and work treated as a reliable one, you have to seek the permission of the great scholar in this field of study.
That's right.
And he was the one who benefited from this opportunity as well, because he is considered as those who got the permission of ijtihad from Sheikh Agha Buzurgi Tehrani.
That's right.
So this work, Rawdatul Jannat, which was authored by his predecessors, Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Khunsari.
Yes.
It was edited, because through the years that he was reading this work, he felt that a strong edition is needed for this work.
That's
I
right.
mean, Rawdatul Jannat. So this is one of the outstanding work that...
So he wrote a sharh on that, isn't it?
And it is not...
A commentary or something?
Yes, it was a commentary and... Sometimes you may say it was addition, sometimes to have
Takmila,
some,
isn't it?
Yes, okay. some input and editing the information which are there. It is not only mere commentary or criticizing the things which are there. Yes,
that's right.
You may say it this way, yeah.
Sheikh Ziyaniyaz, some people might say that what is the use at all to talk about the family tree of an alim? Because Sheikh Rozati also was famous for writing down the family tree of some of the great outstanding scholars. For example, to whom to, or to what imam of the infallible imams the trace or the family tree of this person dates back. What is the use? And explain a little bit about this field of study. It might be very much interesting, isn't it?
Okay, regarding this field of study, first of all, we should know that Ahlul Bayt wasalam, themselves have talked about their genealogy and their, you know, roots of their generation. So it shows that this is important. And also in Ziyarat Jami' al-Kabira, it is quoted from Imam Hadi alayhi salatu wasalam that kuntum fil aslab al-shamikha wal arham al-mutahhara. So it's important to know that from which generation this figure has come. Because the attributions, the behaviors of the grandfathers and grandmothers
have effects on the behavior of the, you know, children. Of course, it's not the absolute cause, but it has some, you know, effects on the behavior of the children. So that's why Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, they were insisting on this point that we are from a pure generation. So now, if someone is from this generation, I mean the generation of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, that is Sadat and are the children of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, so they should be distinguished from other people. Beside this, in fiqh, we have some rules, that these rules are specialized for the children of Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha. For example, regarding khums, it's separated into different sections. First goes to Sadat, and the other one is going to toward the share of Imam. So to, you know, give this share of khums to Sadat, we should know who is this Sadat. So that's why these, you know, points are giving us the importance of the genealogy. And beside this, because people, if you are aware of the background of your family, and you know that my family is a family that was trying to promote the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt Rasulullah Wasallam, I feel this burden more on my shoulders to, you know, take more effective steps in this field and try to take this burden more, you know, further in order to have more promotes in the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt Rasulullah Wasallam. So all of these reasons are maybe mentioned for the importance of this, you know, field of study and field of knowledge.
So we can say that there are some experts who have the expertise of tracing back your genealogy, you know, and family tree to the very original one, if, especially if you are a Sayyid one.
It's and, a knowledge, you know, and, you know, it's, it needs...
what is the name of this type of ilm? Ilm al-Ansab or something?
Yes, ilm al-Ansab. Ilm al-Ansab, or some people, they call it also ilm al-Rijal, but it's ilm al-Ansab.
Ansab, ilm al-Ansab.
Technically, they call it ilm al-Ansab.
Right. As Sheikh Mahtavi also said, the late Rozati was famous for writing takmila, or a kind of completion or annexation, isn't it, to some of the great outstanding books of the Shia history. One of them is Tabaqat al-A'lam al-Shia, which is very much famous, and Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rozati wrote on that. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, anything missed about the late Rozati?
Okay, regarding him, I think this is also good to know that he had collected a very precious manuscripts on Islamic works, that he had been keeping all those manuscripts and books in his library. So it was a very rich library in terms of the Islamic manuscripts.
Was it in Isfahan?
Yes, it was in Isfahan. And besides being such knowledgeable alim, we should not ignore this aspect of his life, that he was really popular among the people, ordinary people. He had a... As we say in Farsi, he was actually taking over the affairs of a masjid in one of the old neighborhood in Isfahan. And people would easily go to him, sit with him, and he was trying to solve the problems of ordinary people. So this aspect, which is always associated with the great ulama of Shia, should not be ignored. So besides their position in terms of knowledge, in terms of akhlaq, in terms of irfan, they had such view and picture among ordinary people that people would go easily to them, sit with them, speak to them from whatsoever problem that they had in their life. And he is also considered as those ulama, and there are a lot of stories and memories that still those people in the neighborhood of Isfahan or here and there, they keep with them. That's nice memories and stories with this alim.
That's all right.
May Allah bless him.
May Allah bless him. So also taking part in many conferences, you know, regarding the study of manuscripts and codicologies in Iran and different countries, the trips that he had in order to collect them was really, really the source of benefit for so many scholars. It was Sha'ban 29, 1433, according